way we tax the oil and gas industry has reached front and center in the gubernatorial campaign. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The ACES system of oil taxes is sure to come up as one of its authors and defenders is here, Senator Hollis French. The phone line's open, 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. In Anchorage, that's a local call at 550-8422, email talk@APRN.org. Hollis French is our guest on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Well, our guest today on this special Thursday edition of Talk of Alaska, and we are doing Talk of Alaska's twice a week between now and the primary election because there are so many different people running for statewide office. Our guest this time is not unknown to the show. He is Senator Hollis French of West Anchorage. Hollis.
Steve, nice to be here. Good morning.
What made you decide to run for governor?
You know, I really saw the state as at a crossroads in a lot of important ways on our economy, on our energy policy, on our educational system. And it was a great time for me to step up and say, I think I have some ideas that can lead us across this crossroads.
Well, you know, it seems that the state is more bipartisan than it has been. It was pretty much of a red state. It's a bit less of a red state now, maybe. And I guess you've been part of that because you're bipartisan, a leader in the bipartisan Senate.
You know, that's one of the, I'm glad you brought that up, the bipartisanship. It's one of the, I think, untold stories of our political system in Alaska compared to, say, the national system, which has become sort of a scorched earth partisanship all day, every day. In Juneau this year was probably the most bipartisan, the most sort of work-oriented atmosphere that I've experienced since I've been there for 8 years. Every day we just sat down to work and tried to solve problems. And it was really refreshing to see my ideas put next to the Department of Law's ideas, next to House Democrats' ideas, and you know, thrash them out and vote on them and go down the road together. It was really something else.
Well, and you were judiciary, right?
Judiciary chairman, yes. And, you know, we worked real well with the governor's office on some crime bills. We passed a real tough campaign finance disclosure law that will benefit the state, I think, in this election cycle. We continued to save money for both a rainy day and for, you know, paying down the big unfunded liability we have in our retirement system. It was a good year.
Well, I guess, Hollis, I can't let it go by without saying, you know, that you were accused of partisanship during the Palin administration and for kind of being in charge of almost a rogue committee there.
In your
Troopergate treatment.
Yeah, that was unfortunate because that, of course, that investigation began with a 8-4 vote to begin the investigation. 8 Republicans, 4 Democrats voted to begin that investigation. I was not a member of that committee. I was simply asked to lead it. And, of course, it was a fairly mild-mannered affair until Governor Palin got named as John McCain's running mate. And suddenly that investigation got sort of in the crosshairs of what I would call, you know, sort of national Republican political operatives sent to Alaska to discredit it. And they did. They sued me. They did everything they could to stop the investigation. But here's what happened at the end. We delivered a report that found in favor of the governor on one point and against her on another. So it was balanced. The investigation came in 25% under budget. So it was not as if we were spending every penny we were given. We were restrained on our budget. 2 courts looked at what we did and both found that no one's rights were violated. So I think, you know, in the end, despite all that political sort of hoo-ha, I did my job. Steve Branchflower did his job. The legislature accepted the report, made it public, and, that little episode kind of started to go away.
So your response to accusations of partisanship is I wasn't the one being partisan.
I was caught in a crossfire. I did my job. I kept my head down and finished the job I was asked to do. I was asked to do a very, very difficult job, and I did it.
Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If calling from Anchorage, our number is 550-8422. Email is talk@APRN.org. Ethan Berkowitz is also running for governor for the Democratic nomination in the primary, probably your main rival in this contest. And for a while, I don't know that we knew that there was any difference between the two of you. But now we definitely have one issue upon which you are definitely in disagreement. Maybe you can, Ethan will be in here next month, and he'll be explaining where he's standing on this. And I will have to say, when we've taken up this issue of how we tax our oil and gas in Alaska, how we tax the producers, it has often been brought up by cooler heads who have called this program and said, you know, you can talk about the gross tax, you can talk about the net tax, you talk about income tax, but it might be simpler just to go to a simple royalty system and base the entire deal on the royalty deal that you have with that producer on that lease. And that's what Berkowitz has come out for, and you basically are standing behind the ACES system, which was, I'm sure you would admit, kind of a political document of practicality, making sausage the way the legislature does. In other words, taking all the political forces and managing to get a piece of legislation out of it.
Welcome to the world of politics, Steve. You know, you can have the brightest idea in the world, but if you actually want to do something, if you want to put a law on the books, you've got to have the votes. I mean, that's the bottom line. And, you know, at the moment that we passed ACES, it was what I would call sort of a once-in-a-lifetime moment, and an array of forces that suddenly were working together. We had the Democrats, who had been pushing oil tax reform since Les Guerra got us started on that in 2005. We had the Republicans split into two camps, pro-Palin and anti-Palin. And we had the field cleared by the Vico scandals of 2006 and 2007, which sort of pushed the oil industry lobbyists to the side and reduced their influence at a rare moment in time. So suddenly you have the field clear. You have us Democrats having studied the issue intensely for 3 years now. We had access to experts who could inform our decision. We had access to data. You know, we saw, just one quick example, in the Judiciary Committee, we had experts bring us information that they had gleaned from the public record, from BP, from Conoco, from Exxon, and from the Alliance on what the profitability of infield drilling, infield wells were at Prudhoe Bay, what the industry made from drilling a well at Prudhoe Bay. And, you know, they put it up in a real-time data display so that you could adjust the tax rate and the progressivity rate and the price of a barrel of oil. And the vast majority of prices and tax rates, BP was making close to 100% profitability on Prudhoe Bay oil wells. And once we learned that, and once we turned to the industry and said, you can respond to this information if you have anything to the contrary, and waited 48 hours and got no response, we were convinced that we were losing billions of dollars in revenue from Prudhoe Bay, the biggest oil field in North America, because we weren't taxing it appropriately. And the difficulty with a royalty-only system is that it does not grab the upside, and it doesn't stimulate the downside. That's the beauty, frankly, of a profits-based system, if you stop and think about it. If you have a high-cost field like West Sac, you know, thick oil, viscous oil, it needs enormous amounts of money spent to get that heavy oil out of the ground. You don't pay a penny of tax, not a penny, until all your costs have been recovered, right? So it lets the industry go in there and spend as much as they need to get that oil out of the ground, because they're not going to pay a penny of tax until they make a profit. On the other hand, at Prudhoe, where they're basically shooting fish in a barrel, okay, in an oil barrel, I guess, you know, we finally get a fair share of that revenue. So it adjusts by itself and takes care of, you know, challenged fields and high profit fields at the same time. That's you know, sort of the key idea behind a profits-based tax.
On Tuesday, we had Ralph Samuels in here, and he said, you do realize that our current rate of state spending is based on $75 oil. I'm a little nervous because the price of oil when he said that was 74 something.
You know, it's true. We are highly reliant on oil. However, you know, that's something that you and I own in common with every other Alaskan, from Ketchikan to Kodiak to Kotzebue. You know, that's their oil. And it's my job as a state legislator to make sure they get a fair share of that. And, you know, if you don't live on the rail belt, if you don't live where the industry is, what you get out of that is some form of funding for your schools, for your roads, for state troopers, for health care. You know, that's what you get out of the oil wealth. And it's my job to make sure you get a fair share of it. You know, we will, you know, someday the oil will go away. But it's not going to go away as fast as some people would have you believe. You know, I worked a dozen years, actually 13 years as a blue collar worker in the oil industry. 5 years on a platform in Cook Inlet. I started as a bulk cook washing pots and pans, moved my way up to being a production operator, running the pumps and the valves and the compressors that make a platform go. I went to the North Slope and spent 8 years working for Kuparik, working for ARCO at Kuparik, doing the same job. So I know something about the industry, and the point I'm making is that when I went to work in Cook Inlet in 1979, the guys there were all proud of the fact that the platform was still pumping oil in 79 because it had been set in 1965, and they were told then the platform would last 10 years, and they were like, look at us, you know, we're still pumping oil, you know, 4 years later. You know what? I went out there 2 years ago. It's still there. It's still pumping oil 30 years later. So for as long as you can imagine, you know, and the point is that, you know, an old oil field manager told me, you never walk away from a producing oil field. Never. And so for as long as you can imagine, they'll be pumping oil out of the North Slope, and it'll be coming down the pipeline. And the same thing to keep in mind is this. There's never been an oil field that didn't peak and then slowly go down in production. You could have a zero production tax. Zero production tax. And we had that at Kuparik for a number of years before we fixed it in 2006 and 2007. And production still goes down. You know, no amount of magic will bring back the peak years of an oil field. So it's, you know, so keeping all those things in mind means you must get a fair share. You must bank that, which we've done. In 2008, when oil prices hit $145 a barrel, we put $5 billion into savings, the single biggest deposit into savings in the state's history. It's something that frankly went unnoticed. I remember the day that news happened, there was a little dispute over in the House over some, you know, little bill, and the news followed the dispute, you know, the little back and forth, and not the $5 billion that went into savings.
Alice French is our guest. He's running for governor of Alaska. He's a Democrat, and the primary election is rapidly approaching. On August 24th, right?
24th, yes.
And I guess this is the point where you put in your pitch for voter registration.
You should get out there and register to vote, no doubt about it. The cutoff will be 30 days before the election, and with today being the 22nd, you've got two more days to register to vote. And of course, our ballot, the Democratic ballot, is open to all comers of all stripe. Grab that ballot, pick your candidate, and I hope you pick me.
Well, you know, why should they? I guess we'll go right to that. You are a, first off, Alaska is not really known too much as a Democratic state. How could you be effective as a governor of Alaska being a Democrat?
You know, I think I've shown that over the last 4 years, particularly in the bipartisan working group, in the group of Republicans and Democrats in the Senate who sit down every day and go to work. You know, I work with people who are ideologically, you know, on the far end of the fence from me. But we sit down and we solve problems. We figure out how to fund schools. We figure out how to, you know, get VPSOs a raise. We talk about, you know, how we're going to make education work better in Alaska. And I've been able to do that in the Senate very well. And over the years, that bipartisanship has, I believe, spread into the House. So I have a great working relationship with the legislature. And I think I've shown that I can sit in the middle and be fair to both sides.
Well, what would your initiatives be? I see that you're kind of pushing education.
I am. I'm talking about two big things, renewable energy and education. On the first, renewable energy, we should be taking our oil revenue and investing that in renewable energy projects around the state.
Are we already doing that? I mean, well, we did see Governor Parnell did veto half of the $50 million appropriated to the Renewable Energy Fund. I do understand those were all projects that had already been vetted through the Alaska Energy Authority, but, you know, he said, well, we'll just do it later. But, I mean, basically, you in the legislature set up the Renewable Energy Fund, and now it appears that you know, they're actually going ahead and spending money each year on it. So what are you saying, more or what?
I am saying more, exactly. You know, the long-term future of the state is to sell our oil, sell our gas to somebody else, let them burn it. And we should be heating our homes and lighting our homes with renewable energy because it never goes away. That's the genius of it. And we as a state should be the absolute leader in that. When the governor vetoed half of this year's renewable energy money, I was extremely frustrated because we've got $12 billion in the bank. Now is the time, in my view, to build Alaska. You know, the era of federal funding for our state, of enormous amounts of federal funding, is over, right? It's, you know, Ted Stevens is gone. Don Young is no longer in charge. The national deficit is going to make priorities change, I think, radically on the federal scene. We as Alaskans need to do it for ourselves, and we have the wherewithal, we have the revenue, and we have the savings to do it. And when the governor vetoed $25 million of renewable energy projects, that was just wrong.
Well, so you're talking about using some of the state's reserves, as I understand it.
If we need to, but we have, I mean, frankly, we have the income, we have the revenue. When I say revenue, mm-hmm. I mean the stream of money that we get every year from that pipeline.
Okay. Would this include, I guess, a couple of things. Burning energy needs, burning, very funny. Energy needs in Alaska. I'm thinking about rural Alaska.
Yes.
We get these calls all the time with people saying, hey, what are you doing for us? Don't you realize all this energy, all these resources are coming from rural Alaska?
Yes.
And do you know what it costs us to live here and buy fuel here? And we hear sort of vague schemes about, well, we can get propane up and down the rivers or this or that. You know, but somehow nothing ever...
Well, we're making progress, and it takes a lot of work, but you need someone at the head of the state who's actually willing to focus on that and make it a priority. You know, I've been to Gamble, I've been to Savunga, I've been to Emonic, I've been to St. Mary's, I've traveled to small places. Last summer with the Resources Committee, we went to Tanana and to Ruby, and I've seen something of rural Alaska. And what you're going to need are small, targeted solutions unique to each location, because it's going to be a long, long time before this state is ever tied together in an electrical grid. It's too expensive to build. But you can find small targeted solutions, whether it's micro hydro or small wind projects or biodiesel, biomass. In Tanana, they have a wood-fired boiler. It seems like a throwback, but they're super efficient. They don't take a lot of wood. The wood keeps coming down the river every day and every year. And they're heating their washateria, their community center, with wood. It works great. There's plenty of wood. And so you've just got to look for a solution for each community that works and then make the investment. We saw a demonstration of a small biodiesel, basically plant that makes biodiesel out of fish waste that will fit in a tractor trailer unit. You can buy one of those for about $3 million. Put it in a village, start turning out synthetic diesel, which is clean burning, and you can keep finding it and making it from fish waste that comes back every year for forever.
Well, yes, but how about things like the bullet line? How about things like we got Donlin Creek that there's no source of power for, and it's going to crunch up that ore, takes a huge amount of power. And then we only started with Pebble and whatever is or is not done there.
Don't get started with Pebble. Just don't even get started.
But
just colossal don't get started.
But mining takes a colossal amount of energy.
It does.
And the energy is not out there. And that's
it
one
does.
Of the reasons why Donlin Creek, which would be a tremendous source of employment out there in the YK Delta area, is, you know, really is kind of stymied right now because they have a power source.
True. And you know, someday they'll have a supply of gas. That's the most likely supply is a supply of gas. The immediate need is to heat homes and light homes and take care of people. You know, and we need jobs, and we've got to have, you know, and I'm not anti-mining. I'm for Red Dog. I'm for Donlin Creek. You know, I don't have a problem with that. But the point is that you got to focus on families first. Focus on people first. And the state has a higher obligation, I believe, to its people than to a mining company called Donlin Creek. You know, they've got to solve their energy problem, and we'll help them, but it's not the number one priority. That's my view.
And bullet line or some way of getting natural gas to Cocaine Letter? Are you one of those who believes that we can somehow stimulate more exploration and that the gas is probably already there in the inlet?
There is lots of gas in Cook Inlet. I worked on a platform in Cook Inlet for 5 years. There's lots and lots of gas. And we passed a bill this year that should stimulate more drilling there, more exploration. The difficulty, as you know and your listeners know, because they're smart people, they listen to public radio, is that the size of the market is so small. If Marathon or Chevron were to go out and make an enormous find of gas in Cook Inlet, they couldn't turn it into money very fast. They can't monetize it. So their incentive to go find that big supply of gas is somewhat limited until we are exporting gas in volumes, not the small export license that we have in Kenai.
What? That's small?
It is small. It's a small
amount.
Who knew?
I think it still is the nation's
it's
only,
the only
LNG
one.
Plant.
It's the only one. It's the only one, but it's a fairly
and
small.
And it's small.
It is small. Yep.
Damn.
I toured that plant. It's a fascinating place. And it's a great benefit, and it's a boon to consumers in the inlet because it provides sort of a shock absorber in the winter when we need gas delivered to our homes. They export less; they make that available for us to burn.
So even with the LNG plant, even with the urea plant,
urea plant, right?
I know, right. But they could come back.
It could come back, although that's a world. I mean, it's interesting. Fertilizer basically chases the lowest natural gas prices possible.
They chase
them around the world. It's a worldwide commodity. It's a worldwide industry.
Right, and it was the price that did them in.
Wasn't the supply; it was the price. A lot of folks say, it was the supply, but that's not right. It was the price. When the price of cooking oil gas got too high, they packed up and left town.
So the geology is promising. The exploration is lacking because the market is not.
The market's not big enough.
Yeah,
market's not big
so
enough.
Weird. You got the whole rail belt there.
You already got
pipes in.
Compare us to a small suburb of a large town in California, or anywhere in the Midwest, we're a small market. But there will be a big pipe built. There will be. The supply is too rich. Our political climate is too stable. The location of the gas is too well known. It isn't as if you have to go out and find it. That gas will go to market. But here's what we're in the middle of. We're in the middle of a negotiation with the oil industry over the economic terms of how that gas comes to market. And it's just like you're trying to sell your house. And let's say your house is worth $300,000. All right. If you want to sell that house to me right now for $50,000, I'll do it. I'll do it sight unseen. Let's sign the deal. Come on, let's do it. I can get you a pipeline tomorrow. You and everybody else, if you're willing to give away your resource at a horrible price. That's what the oil industry asked of us in 2006 with the Frank Murkowski gas line contract. We were selling our house for $50,000. If your house is worth $300,000 and you want $295,000 for it, you're going to have to fight. And you're fighting with some of the brightest, most intelligent, most relentless negotiators on the earth. And so you've got to be tough. You've got to be willing to wait. You might have to take 6 months or a year to sell that house if you want the full value of it. And that's what we're in the process of doing exactly.
So, bullet line?
I'm not opposed to a bullet line. It may happen, but I have concern over the economics. Frankly, you want the biggest pipe possible. The biggest pipe possible carries the most gas. The economics of gas are not as powerful as the economics of oil. And so you need to move a lot of gas to make money.
Gas hub?
Gas hub is not a bad idea. I think what you'll see is us explore and vet that gas hub idea carefully once we see what comes out of this open season. You'll sort of have a better idea of how far apart we are from the oil industry. We're going to see their bids. And if their bids say, $275,000 for the house, we might just say, let's take it and move on. But if they say, $50,000 for the house, we might say, no thanks, gas hub.
Point Thompson.
We fought and fought and fought the industry for years to get them to move on Point Thompson, and it's still an ongoing fight.
Yeah, well, we got a pipeline halfway there. It goes to Badami,
That's the start.
Yeah. Okay, well, are you ready for calls, Hollis?
Let's talk to some listeners.
All right, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call from Anchorage at 550-8422, and from Denali Park, here is David. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Hollis French.
Great. Good morning, Hollis.
Hi, David.
Hollis, I have a question about the voter initiative process and how we have, for example, three times voted to ban aerial wolf hunting, and yet it goes on, and that we passed a $50 head cruise ship tax, and that has been reduced. What is it, a statutory thing? Is it a constitutional thing? And do you think it is appropriate for the legislature to modify those?
That's a great question, David. You know, it is, the Constitution says that there shall be a power of initiative, which we, you know, at statehood granted, it's sort of a phenomenon of Western states that citizens have a way to jump over the legislature if the legislature won't move on a subject like cruise ship taxes or clean water discharge, which was really, you know, that cruise ship measure was as much about clean water as it was about the $50 and wolf hunting from the air and so forth. The difficulty, of course, is that oftentimes those measures which go through a committee process, and I'll just say it, it's a rare bill that is not improved by having many minds pick it apart and discuss it from both sides of the aisle. You know, that ballot initiative doesn't get picked apart, doesn't get debated, doesn't get improved upon. It gets cooked up by some, you know, smart, well-meaning people, put on the ballot, passes or fails, and then you have it.
Hey, we've got one that's been cooked up by Howie Rich, for Pete's sake.
Yeah, you know, and that's sort of the flip side of the equation, is that, you know, you've got to be aware of just as there are ballot initiatives that you completely agree with, David, and you completely support, there are ballot initiatives that you would find highly repugnant, and you want to have some ability, if you don't defeat it at the ballot box, to be able to modify it after a certain length of time. There's no law that you can put on the books that never changes. You know, it's sort of like the eternal struggle, right? You know, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. That's just the way it works. Every day you get up and you go to work and you say, you know, is there something we need to fix? Is there something we need to defend? Is there something we need to go after? And that's the process. I think we reached a fair balance to answer your question, which I think you're asking is, how long should a ballot initiative be untouched? My view is 2 years is a pretty good time to see if it's working, give the voters their say, and then come back in and see if it can be improved.
But isn't the cruise ship, the head tax, a good example of how a powerful lobbying group can influence the legislature to override the will of the public?
It's an excellent example, and I guess I'd say, unfortunately, that's democracy. You know, I voted against that. I didn't want to roll those taxes back. My view was that, you know, we hadn't seen evidence that they would bring us more cruise ship people in exchange for less cruise ship taxes. It looked to me like that money was going to flow straight to the top of the cruise ship industry to a few very wealthy individuals in exchange for exactly nothing. But, you know, unfortunately, that's the process. You know, the alternative is to have laws set in stone you cannot change. And I think that's risky, especially if you get a ballot initiative passed in a, you know, sort of an unusual political season, which turns out to be really, really bad.
Right. So the bottom line is that it's a statutory.
I think the 2 years is statutory, but the right of initiative is, of course, set in the Constitution.
Yeah,
okay, very good. That answers my question. Thanks so much.
Yeah, and David, I think we'll revisit this. I have that on my list of subjects, just the issue of initiative, the power of initiative, and you know, how it's done in Alaska, because it was certainly something they talked about a lot at the Constitutional Convention, exactly how much power they wanted the voters to have.
And David's right. You know, it was a reaction. The power initiative is a reaction to the enormous power that banks and railroads had in the Midwest and the West as expansion took place, and those enormously powerful economic interests basically ran the state capitals. And people were getting, you know, unfair deals left and right out of those legislatures where you know, taxes were reduced for banks, taxes were reduced for railroads, you know, farmers got nothing, and there was a backlash, and that's the power of initiative.
Yeah. And it's a fun thing to talk about, but it's very complicated civics, and when you go and read the court rulings on it and how they handle it and how they'll allow things that are probably unconstitutional to go ahead and appear on the ballot and so forth, there's a lot to talk about there. Let's try and get one more in before we take the break. Robert in Anchorage, you're on the air with Hollis French running for governor.
Thank you, Steve. I think it's an excellent job you're doing of exposing us to primary candidates the weeks before the primary.
Thank you.
Good morning, Hollis.
Good morning, Robert.
I have a follow-up on renewable energy, if I might, and then a comment. The a previous governor threatened to veto substantial amounts of federal funding that would have gone to provide proper insulation in public buildings, and perhaps the low-income weatherization program was also affected. And I believe the excuse at the time was perhaps some political posturing, but it related to, oh, we might have to do a building standard 15 years from now if we accepted the money. There were some federal strings, as there usually are on federal money, but I recall that you were involved in an effort to get legislation to at least surface that issue, to address it directly, and I think the ultimate result was to get the funding. My question is, do you view energy conservation as a part of renewable energy, and what was the ultimate result of that effort to remove the federal funding from the state?
Great questions, Robert. Short answer was we never got all the money we should have gotten. We could not override the governor's vetoes of those federal funds, but we pushed as hard as we could to get her to change her mind. But on the subject of renewables, yes, energy conservation is, you know, what they call the low-hanging fruit of an energy policy. A barrel of oil you don't burn, a gallon of diesel you don't burn is something that's in the bank. It hasn't cost you anything. It's you know, it makes the world better, it makes your bank account better. It's win-win-win all the way around. And this year we passed a big comprehensive energy bill out of the Senate Resources Committee and out of the legislature altogether, dealing with, and specifically one of the things you raised was, you know, insulation for public buildings. It was surprising how hard the administration fought to keep that from being part of the bill. Chris Rose was extremely happy with and praised the bill we passed. It established an energy policy for the state. It mandated, conserving energy in state buildings, and took a lot of action to, you know, stimulate renewable energy exploration. It was a big success.
Robert, your response quickly.
The comment briefly is that I am very impressed with Hollis. He's smart. He's an effective campaigner. I think that the kinds of issues that he's staked out, education, renewable energy, his expertise on judicial matters, and pretty good knowledge of the Constitution of Alaska, all would serve Alaska well as a governor. Thank you.
Well, that's quite the endorsement.
Thank you, Robert.
All right, Robert, thank you for your call. It's Hollis French, our guest on a Thursday Talk of Alaska, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. Crane accidents are on the rise around the nation. Making sure that crane operators are properly trained and certified is crucial to minimizing accidents in Alaska. Equally important is ensuring that riggers and signal persons are adequately trained. More information is available at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Well, this is Talk of Alaska, and our guest is Hollis French. He's a Senate Judiciary Chairman, and he's running for governor as a Democrat. And his opposition is mainly Ethan Berkowitz in the Democratic primary. So you haven't run for statewide office before, have you?
No, it's my first statewide run, Steve, and it's a fascinating exercise. You know, I literally have campaigned from Ketchikan to Barrow. I went to Barrow in January, spent, 48 hours up there. There was an assembly meeting, a good time to see folks who had come in from some of the villages and talked to them all at once, visited their science center and looked around Barrow. Been to Ketchikan, going back to Ketchikan next month. Sitka, Bethel, Fairbanks, I went to last trip to Bethel. I got in a riverboat with Mike Williams and went up the river to Akiak and Akachak and took a look at some really small villages that are mainly accessed only by river and by air. And it was, just a fascinating day to look at, life in a tiny village of 150 people and how that world is so different than the world I'm more accustomed to here in Anchorage.
Let's try some more calls here, Hollis French. Here's Carol, joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Carol.
Hi, Hollis. I've got a couple of questions for you. I'll try to be as brief as possible. One would be regarding health care. I just read in the Fairbanks paper that the Division of Public Health is running out of their federal grant money that is for much of their operations, as well as Governor Parnell is working on the next budget and says that Medicaid is one of the things that are making the budget run up, and he's looking for ways to cut on health care. I'm just wondering, what are your responses to that? What would your differences in dealing with this be? And I also have one other question. It would be on your policies on fish and game, and how does that differ from what they're doing now? What initiatives would you take if you were in office regarding the fish and game policy?
Great questions, Carol. Thanks. First on health care.
Okay. Yeah, that's the whole rest of the show there, I think.
I could wrap up the show.
You know, on health care, we could spend an hour just on that topic. It really is something I took a hold of in 2008. We began working on a bill that would provide affordable health insurance to all Alaskans. And we made a lot of progress on that. But when the national bill passed, my bill became moot, essentially. The national bill took care of that, making affordable health insurance available to all Americans, I think, is a good thing. I was stunned and disappointed when the governor sued to stop that. You know, it's just amazing to me that a public official would get in the way of an idea that's made to help the people who live in his state get access to affordable health insurance. I just disagreed strongly. I've sent letters asking for how much that's going to cost the Department of Law to the Attorney General. I want to find out, you know, how much we're spending to keep Alaskans from getting access to affordable health insurance. It's something I'll keep fighting. And so it's just a sort of a baseline idea, which is, you know, you get everybody insured, first of all. Get everybody under the tent. It's how insurance works. We all pitch in something for insurance, and if lightning strikes you or your neighbor, that person has coverage, has access to health insurance. I think it's basically the best way right now in our current sort of political world to solve the problem of health care, which is, first of all, get everybody insured. Second of all, start working on ways to contain costs. You should, however, get a drop in costs once folks are insured, because we know that the cost of the uninsured is enormous. We know that folks who don't have insurance don't go to the doctor. They don't, you know, have their medical problems addressed until they're sick. And once you're sick, you go to the emergency room instead of going to a, you know, primary care physician, and the problems compound. So I think the federal solution is a step in the right direction, and we'll see improvements on that over the years. But I would not have sued to stop that. And I guess just about the, you know, how we can reduce costs to Medicaid and so forth, you know, my big initiative would be on telemedicine. It's something that the, the Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corp, YKHC, is pushing aggressively there in the YK Delta to allow clinicians at clinics in the small villages communicate face-to-face with doctors, either in Bethel or in Anchorage, and have their patients seen through telemedicine. It's, you know, it's a way. It requires, you know, broadband access. It requires good internet connections, but it's a way to reduce transportation costs, which we spend a lot of money on here in Alaska, and it's a way to, you know, get problems looked at more quickly before they become acute and require a trip to either a regional hub like Bethel or a center like Anchorage or even Seattle.
And the fish and game question?
You know, one of the great victories of this year's legislative session was defeating Al Barrett, who had been named to the Board of Game by Governor Parnell. He turned out to be something of an extremist on fish and game views, was equating, you know, his policies with the Book of Genesis and so forth. And it was an unusual moment, because we don't usually win victories like that. But we did in Juneau take Al Barrett off of the Board of Game. And I think it spoke to the legislature's desire, my desire, to see more science used in our work. And that's, you know, to me, that's, if it all boils down to one word, it's use science, rely on scientists, you know, make sure that the people who are in positions of power in the Board of Fish and the Board of Game, the people who work for you in your administration, are working off of science and not off of some preconceived idea or some allegiance to a certain interest group, you know, whether it's, you know, this hunting group or that fishing group or so forth. You know, as long as you're making decisions based on science, you'll be getting the best result you can. You'll be looking after the long-term game and long-term fish management. We have a pretty good record in Alaska of managing our own fish and game. You know, particularly on fish, we've been the envy of other nations who have looked to us for management techniques. And it's always got to boil back down to using data, analyzing the data dispassionately, and making sure that your decisions are not influenced by politics or by allegiance to an interest group.
Carolyn Fairbanks?
All right. Hollis, thank you very much for your answers, and I'll definitely be voting for you.
Aren't you kind?
Okay. All right, you have a good day.
Another softball. I can't believe it. Okay, here's one that might be a little tougher. This is from Pamela. How would he get rural communities to be more active or invited to Alaska government decisions? For example, the state's moving National Guard out of rural Alaska, consolidating to the hubs only. But I don't hear any discussion on this in the last 2 or 3 years. The same is true for senior services, libraries, even access to government offices. And indeed, there is a, largely because of cost, there's actually an emptying out going on in rural Alaska.
Rural Alaska is absolutely in a vice grip of energy costs. And you can't blame a parent, a mother, a father who says to their family, look, we can't keep spending $8 a gallon for heating oil to heat the home. We're leaving our ancestral home. We're leaving the home where my father and my grandfather lived. We're moving to Fairbanks. We're moving to Anchorage. We're going to Juneau. We're leaving these highly expensive small communities where the way of life is wonderful, where our cultural and our historical roots are, and we have to go to a city hub where it's a different world. And that's because we as Alaskans and we as a government have not made the same investments in infrastructure there that we've made in other parts of the state. If we had spent the same amount on infrastructure in Bethel as we have in Fairbanks, energy costs.
You know how much money's been poured into trying to control erosion on that river?
A lot, but you know what? When you look at it on a per capita basis over the history of Bethel and the history of the state compared, it's not the same. And my view is that, when they've had the same investments in infrastructure that we made in the rest of the state, things will be better. And now we have the opportunity to do that, especially in energy costs. It's the cost of energy that's bringing rural Alaska to its knees. I feel very passionate about this. I want to fix that. I love rural Alaska. I'm a hiker and a climber and a skier, and I'm also a person, when I was a prosecuting attorney, I made 3 trips to St. Paul Island because it's a fascinating place, and I would go out there and deal with criminal cases, and then you'd be, confronted by one of the most amazing, wild places in the world. Same with Bethel, same with Dillingham. I went to both those places as a DA to help out and do cases because, I wanted to see the communities, and you want to get an idea for what's out there. So rural Alaska is a big part of my campaign, big part of my life.
All right. Let's go to Caroline, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Hollis French.
Thank you so much, and good morning. I'm very pleased to hear you say science, defend on science. Two things. One of them has to do with the initiative process that you mentioned. People do trump corporate money. I know that the successful initiative for taxes on the cruise industry, they had a $2 million budget. Advertising budget, and that's still the Alaskan people said this needs to be done. And again, in terms of getting the money out of politics, I remember the initiative for clean elections was defeated last year, or 2 years ago, rather, and it's successful in 7 states and in the city of Portland. What do you have in mind for that? And one more quick question on taxes. I remember when they set up the original oil field taxes, and they did not tax gas in place as they do in Texas and a lot of other states. We would have had a gas line within 5 years after the pipeline. That's my theory, if we had been taxing gas in place. As it is, we've been a giant lockbox, if you will, or safe deposit box for the industry. And that gas, which in part belongs to us. So those two things, what can you do or what are you willing to do? And I'm also glad, having traveled extensively throughout rural Alaska, to hear your comments and your knowledge about that area, because there are so many experts in the law and in education there, people whose names are not necessarily known, who could certainly contribute greatly to solving the problems there.
All right.
Caroline, great points. Let's start with the first things first, clean elections. I'm a supporter. I think that is ultimately the way we will go. The way you get money out of politics is you pay for those elections with public money, and you have to qualify. You have to be a serious candidate. You have to get, you know, sort of signatures from your neighbors showing you got, you know, sort of a minimum amount of support. And once you do that, you get some public money and you go off and campaign. I wouldn't be averse to making the campaign season shorter either. I started campaigning a year ago. Today, hey, it is. I started on July 22nd in Fairbanks, in Memorial Park in downtown Fairbanks, and said, I am running for governor. And I had a small group of people there, and we got started. It's a long process. Of course, partly it's a big state to cover the whole state. I don't think the First Amendment will let us reduce the campaign season, but I think you can go to publicly funded elections. We have reduced the amount of money that any individual can give to a campaign down to $500, which is a huge amount of money to some folks. But when you compare that to the federal limit, which is $2,400 per individual, it shows that, you know, in Alaska, we take this seriously. It means you've got to broaden your campaign, work harder, talk to more people, make your campaign more democratic with a small D, like, you know, spread out amongst more people. And I think that's a good thing. Let's talk about gas and the North Slope. Caroline, you touched on an idea about how we had taxed the gas in place through something called a reserves tax. I think that's one of the weapons we keep in our quiver. But I want to talk to you about a related idea that it touches on, and that's called the duty to produce. A lot of folks forget that when it comes to the oil industry in Alaska, we are the landlord and they are the tenant. Right? We are the landlord. They are the tenant. We gave them a lease to the property, just like you lease an apartment to someone. They signed the lease. And the lease, what did we give them the lease for? Why did we do that? We want them to explore for and produce oil and gas. We didn't give it to them to sit on the property. We didn't give it to them to have them wait. We said, look, we want you to explore for and produce oil and gas. And when it comes to gas, you might be able to say, you know what? You're really not getting the job done. We told you to explore for and produce oil and gas. You've let us down. Been a long time. Time for you to move. Time to maybe evict you and get a different tenant who will actually get busy exploring for and producing oil and gas. It's called the duty to produce. We've had some fascinating hearings in the Judiciary Committee on that topic from a guy named Spencer Hosey and other experts who make their living, you know, sort of bringing the oil industry to its obligations under its leases. And I think as governor, I would instruct my attorney general to get busy on a duty to produce brief and get ready to file that to sort of tune up the oil industry and say, look, it's time for you to bring your gas to market. You don't get to wait until you can make the most money possible. That's not what the lease says. The lease says you've got to get going and make a reasonable profit. That's the difference. They're waiting for the max, and we need just a reasonable profit for them to get moving to bring their gas to market.
Well, I thank you very much for that. And I remember when I worked on the TAPS line that the line was designed for at least 6, and I think maybe more than that, gas lines to be built underneath the TAPS line. So the right-of-way is there. And according to their filings with the feds, they were supposed to be doing that. So, again, I thank you for that and your other plans, especially for the rural areas, because folks are moving not just because of schools and high costs. They're moving because of crime. And one of the crimes I think that Murkowski did was to get rid of the VPSO program. And so many villages suffered, and the cost for prosecuting and troopers to fly into different places more than cost what the VPSO program would have.
Yeah, so, well, you can't say that about the incumbent. You know, he's been pushing VPSOs.
He has taken some steps that we encouraged him on. I was part of the VPSO task force with Senator Donnie Olson and others, Loretta Bullard, Myron Nanning. We traveled around the state, took a lot of testimony, proposed a big pay increase for VPSOs, pushed that through the legislature, and it's true the governor's taken some steps towards hiring more as well.
And that's very good because, you know, as someone who pays attention to money, that the cost during that period of time shot up in terms of prosecutions.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
All right. It's Talk of Alaska. Our guest is Hollis French, and we'll be back with more of your calls as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
It is Talk of Alaska, and Hollis French is our guest. He's a state senator. He's running for the Democratic nomination for governor of Alaska. And I don't know how well you know the politics of Alaska, but it is not unknown for a Democrat to get elected governor. We have a lot of independent people that are not registered to one particular party, and it has happened in the past, but it's a very difficult political exercise to assemble those different interests into enough votes to get elected.
True enough. You know, although I think, you know, Alaskans are famous for voting the person and not the party. And so I'm looking forward to having the chance to meet as many people as possible and let them look me in the eye, shake my hand, and I'm happy to talk to anybody about anything.
Let's go to another one here. Robert C. in Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Robert, with Hollis French.
Hello. Hollis, this is Professor Robert Crosman over at UAA. And long ago, you were a student of mine in Shakespeare class where I got to know you. And do you remember that?
I sure do. And you know, it was that I'm still so thankful to the English department. I was working 84 hours a week on the North Slope and taking a full load of classes at UAA on my days off. And, you know, they were so kind about letting me tape classes and make up work. And, you know, I couldn't quit that great paying North Slope job for, you know, an undergraduate degree. It just didn't make sense. But I really was interested in pursuing my education. I was, you know, in my late 20s, early 30s. And so those were good times.
Yes, and I remember that, well, students come first at UAA, and I had an attendance requirement, and I put it in abeyance for you because you made a convincing case that you needed to be dealt with as an individual, and you were a star student in that class nonetheless, and I'm so glad I did it. You come across as a very intelligent person, which of course you are. You also come across as a man of a warm person, a man of the people, and I rejoice at your UAA background, then supplemented with a high-powered law school at Cornell. But I wonder what your vision is for the University of Alaska generally, and the University of Alaska Anchorage in particular. I know you have it at heart as an alumnus, but I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Great question. I'm a strong supporter. I'm a UAA booster. You know, it's a great university. You know, it should be a first rate one. You know, this is Alaska. You know, our university should be something that is as big as our mountains and as great as our land. And we've got a fantastic nucleus upon which to build there. One of the things I want to do for students is to de-bottleneck some choke points we right now have in popular programs like nursing and engineering. There are classes you just can't get in those areas, and they delay the time that you can graduate. They make you take classes longer. You have to wait, and so I'm really interested in de-bottlenecking some choke points to make the flow of students through the university easier. You know, it's all about at some level customer service, but it's also about investment. You know, for years we flat funded the university in the mid 80s to mid 90s. You know, the university just suffered through flat funding, and so I think we're still catching up. We've made some investments in buildings here in Anchorage. We're hoping to build the BIOS Center in Fairbanks. I'm a strong supporter of that building there. I would have paid for it, frankly, out of the budget. That was what the governor proposed. Unfortunately, it wound up on the ballot proposition. I hope it passes.
Well, it's going to be on there along with a sports arena.
Yeah, and you know, and I like the idea of a sports arena, but frankly, you know, a place that teaches science is a better investment. You know, it's funny if you look at every strong economy worldwide, at the center of that economy is a strong education system, pumping out intelligent graduates. You know, you and I don't know what challenges Alaska is going to face in 20 years. We don't know what kind of problems we're going to leave for the next generation. We need smart young Alaskans to solve those. And the way you do that is you start in pre-kindergarten and you finish through the university and you make sure you've got a powerhouse education system so that our problems are solved by our people.
Robert?
Yeah. The brain drain of our most able and intelligent students out of the state to go to universities that they perceive as higher quality is a real problem with education in Alaska. And the old president has instituted that President Scholars Program, whereby we keep more of the top performing students in the state, and I think that's going to pay real dividends and could be expanded, could be improved, and equally the need for a better outreach to the minority communities and getting some of that talent from high school into the university where we try to take good care of them is a really important initiative, and I hope you'll support more support for students who can't afford to go to college without some help from the state.
Well, he says he wants to be the education governor, so...
Absolutely. And you know, Robert's right. Professor Crossman, I should say. We tried this year to compromise and reach a compromise on, you know, a merit scholarship like the governor proposed and a needs-based scholarship, which I tend to favor. And, you know, in politics, you know, when ideas like that clash, you tend to do a little of both and actually achieve something. That compromise was rejected. We wound up with no funding. I think that was a mistake. We should have gone ahead and put, you know, we have the shell of the idea on the books, but no money. And basically in politics, you put your money where your mouth is. And we should have funded that. We should have funded some needs-based.
On top of this tremendous backlog of funds, we're very lightly taxed here in Alaska, and yet the ruling majority of Republicans, all they can talk about is reducing taxes, the burden on the taxpayer, and how we have to control state spending because, boo-hoo, we're poor, and we aren't poor at all.
Well, Professor, you definitely have filibustered your way right to the end of the show. I want to thank you so much.
Sorry.
It's all right. Yeah, Hollis French, don't really have time for a finishing statement, so I guess I'll throw one ambush question at you. Do you think the Parnell administration made the right kind of settlement with Mercer?
You know what? I actually helped get that lawsuit started. I wrote a letter many years ago to Attorney General Marquez. I got a nice shout out from the Attorney General at the settlement. I appreciate that. You know, Dan Sullivan, the Attorney General, has been very generous. Ultimately, I think you take $500 million and you say that's pretty good.
Okay. And do you think it'll go back into the retirement fund?
It should. We asked the governor to use that as a down payment on a return to a stable retirement system for all public employees, teachers, firefighters, police officers, to get them a fair retirement.
All right. Thank you very much. Hollis French, running for governor of Alaska as a Democrat. The next Talk of Alaska coming up on Tuesday is going to be Mead Treadwell running for lieutenant governor as a Republican. Dave Waldron at the controls, Josh Edge and BD Trantina on the phones. I am Steve Heimel, and thank you so much for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.